there were these woods out there, and the thought did cross my mind at the time, is he watching us? So it was a bit of an unnerving moment when she started tossing out the machetes and swords.
Machetes and Swords. It sounds like a TV drama, but it actually was part of one reporter's intrepid investigation. This is The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative journalists reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. I'm Joaquin Sapien. According to the FBI, roughly one in three homicides is never solved. But thanks to investigative reporter Jerry Mitchell, at least one suspected serial killer is no longer at large. Mitchell is a writer for Mississippi's Clarion Ledger and a 2006 Pulitzer finalist. He spent several years reporting and writing about Felix Vail, a man who lived free for decades despite ties to three murders. Mitchell's investigation began with a tip from a woman named Mary Rose. She was the mother of Felix Vail's fifth wife, who went missing in 1984. Rose had spent years investigating her daughter's disappearance. She discovered that Vail was also suspected of killing two other women he had relationships with. She told Mitchell she was going to try and confront Vail at his trailer in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Eager to chase down a good story, Mitchell decided to join her. And that's where this episode of The Breakthrough begins. What did you know about Felix Vail before you showed up with Mary Rose that day at his trailer?
When I met Mary Rose in May of 2012, all I knew about Felix Vail was just what she had told me, that his first wife had drowned accidentally, and the other two women that he had been with had disappeared. And that literally was all I knew. I knew nothing beyond what she had said. That was it.
So then you meet her. All you know about this guy is that he may have been involved in the disappearances of two women, potential murder of a woman. And you go and meet her, and she takes you to his trailer, and she breaks into it, and she's tossing machetes around. I mean, my heart would have been in my throat. What was that like for you?
I was wondering where he was. I mean, I got to be honest. There were these woods out there, and the thought did cross my mind at the time: is he watching us? So it was a bit of an unnerving moment when she started tossing out the machetes and swords. Because I was thinking, all of a sudden now I'm going, oh, okay. I think maybe I might believe you here.
Right. It becomes a little bit more real from just somebody calling on the phone
exactly.
In hysterics to being at the guy's trailer and she's tossing around weapons. And then it sounds like the next revelation for you came pretty soon after that, where you're having a meal and she hands you these manila folders. What's in them?
There are all these newspaper articles, coverage of the first death, you know, Mary Horton Vail. Basically, there was a search for a couple of days for a body in the Calcasieu River, which is in Lake Charles, and then recovering her body and then the autopsy. I mean, to me, an autopsy is always critical because an autopsy can tell you whether someone died of foul play or not. I mean, potentially can tell you that. And those were kind of like the main documents she had. I actually went after that and did a sweep of the records with the sheriff's office. And really, they didn't have much more.
So then you decided to send the autopsy to a New York pathologist named Dr. Michael Baden. Why?
You know, I read through it, but I didn't feel qualified, so that's why I sent it to Dr. Baden. I knew that he would be able to look at that and give me some kind of assessment. It was one of many things. I was kind of running down a lot of rabbit trails, but that was obviously the most significant one. I knew it was.
So now Dr. Baden decided that there could well have been a homicide. It looked like she may have been gagged with a scarf. If that's the case, then why didn't the district attorney in Lake Charles choose to prosecute Vail? What did you find out about that office?
It was very fascinating. I went down to Lake Charles, and I wanted to see what happened. Did the grand jury consider this? If so, why didn't they indict? I knew that much by that point. And so I just started digging through the records. And so I was literally flipping through 1962. And as I'm flipping through it, I start noticing all these dismissals, like criminal cases that are dismissed. And I don't just mean like a few, 882 criminal charges that were dismissed by the district attorney's office in 1962, which is when this happened.
Wow.
And I thought, that is a tremendous number. And not long after that, met with a criminal defense lawyer from those days. And he gave me all sorts of insight into the district attorney. He was like, yeah, he would do that as kind of for political favors. And they kind of took advantage of it as defense lawyers. He's talking about how he used to bring cookies and things to the district attorney's office.
So this is quite a moment you're having then. I mean,
yeah, I know. Isn't that wild?
I'd say. So, I mean, you've got this alleged serial killer, and now you have an autopsy suggesting that there was, in fact, a homicide. You have heard from a well-known pathologist that there could well have been a murder here. You go down to the courthouse, and you look through the cases from that year, and hundreds of cases have been dismissed, which is very bizarre. You then talk to people who were familiar with the DA at the time and learn that was kind of a matter of course. Were you excited at this point? How were you feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I was very excited when it came out. It's the longest piece that we had at one time in print, basically. And it literally took up like 8 pages of the newspaper.
And just give us the broad strokes, if you could, of what was in that first 9,000-word story.
I kind of told the story of Felix Vail and the women who crossed his path. So he marries Mary Horton in July of 1961. Exactly a year later, they have a son, Bill. Felix Vail, it turns out, had taken out 2 life insurance policies on her, literally just months before this. She supposedly drowns, and their son, Bill, is 3 months old. Fast forward to 1970, you know, nothing happens. Felix Vail walks away, no prosecution. His son, Bill, is 8 years old, and they're kind of like living off the land, you know, living off grapes and vineyards and kind of tromping around, and his son basically goes to the police station at 8 years old in Livingston, California, walks in the door and talks to the detective and says, my dad keeps giving me drugs. I don't want drugs. And, oh, by the way, I overheard my father say that he killed my mother.
Wow.
And so, incredible. And the way I got that story was, the son of Felix Vail, before he died, recorded, it was like a podcast that he recorded with his pastor.
How did you get that tape?
I found out about it, and then I believe it, Will Horton had a copy of it.
And Will Horton was the brother.
Will Horton is Mary Horton Vail's brother.
It's one of the fascinating things about this story is that you were able to earn the trust of so many relatives here, both of Vail's family and the family of the victims. How'd you go about doing that?
Well, I'm just interested in people and interested in talking to them and listening to them. When Mary Rose and I went to Felix Vail's trailer, before we left, it turned out basically Felix Vail's sister wanted to talk to us. So we ended up going and sitting down with Felix Vail's sister for about an hour. And she believed her own brother was guilty. That was wild. And then the brother, this was wild, the brother of Felix Vail, who really was kind of protective of him, after the piece came out, I talked to him. He was actually seriously ill at the time. And he said to me, I want to thank you for what you're doing.
Wow. I mean, there's so many revelations and breakthroughs and twists and turns in the story that it's almost hard to keep up. And there were, of course, hurdles as well. One that I'd like to dwell on a little bit was Vail's disappearance. So in addition to getting all of these calls after your first story comes out, that helps you kind of build this mosaic of his life, you come to learn that he disappeared. Take us into that moment when you first found that out and tell us how you felt about it.
So I'm working on this story. I'm investigating all this after I've gotten all this from Mary Rose. And I get a phone call from Felix Vail's sister that basically that Felix is gone. Like, he got his trailer and he left. I'm like, what? So, you know, I called the brother. He's like, I don't know where he went. And we were kind of talking about the cases, too. And I was like, you know, the FBI ever questioned you? And he's like, no, I'm surprised they didn't. But he had no idea where he went. The sister had no idea where he went. I called some other relatives. They didn't know. Friends, they didn't know. So it was just like he just completely vanished.
You know, the thing that I'm also wondering about is how you wound up finding him again.
So when Gone came out, and, you know, quite a number of people read it, including people out of state, because it was online. And so I got a phone call. Felix Vail, there were certain, you know, things that he was continuing to pay or be paid. And so he had to get his mail somewhere. So it was like a forwarding address that he left. And that's how I caught him, was a forwarding address.
And it turns out he's where?
Canyon Lake, Texas. All I had was a P.O. box. I didn't have a street address at that point.
So the next step after that?
After one of my times down to Lake Charles, I've been going through court records. I was there with Will Horton. That was the brother of Mary Horton. And so he goes to meet with the district attorney while I'm sitting there going through the records. And I get a phone call from him. It's like, hey, Jerry, you'll never guess. I'm in the DA's office getting ready to meet with the DA. He's from my hometown, Eunice, Louisiana. So I came over. And the district attorney, you could tell he was somewhat interested in the case, if there was enough evidence to prosecute, I guess you could say. And so there was a deputy that was put on the case. He and I start having conversations, and he was very good to share information. I don't know how other reporters are, but this is kind of my rule, that I'm willing to share information if people share it back, like it's a two-way street. What I don't ever like is, if someone expects me to share information and I'm not getting anything in return, there's no trade or whatever you want to call it. So he was very good about trading information. So I was happy to tell him what I had on Felix Vail, that I had this P.O. box for him. And so he was able to, and I think the FBI may have actually been involved in helping this, but basically got the land records that showed Felix Vail had gotten this property from a buddy of his. The property where he was living in Canyon Lake, Texas, in January of 2013. Now the case is reopened. The deputy goes to confront Felix Vail. Felix Vail kind of like laughing, and it kind of gets under the deputy's skin, you know. So that was, I think, an important moment because it kind of fired the deputy up that he wanted to really do something about it.
So another key moment is your meeting private investigator Gina Frenzel. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Gone comes out. She reads the ebook. She contacts me by email and volunteers her services, basically. That's thanks. You know, I might take you up on that at some point. And then when I'm starting to look into the fire that took place on the property Felix Vail had, it was ruled an arson. And it seemed to me that he might have had something to do with it, because I was extremely suspicious in my mind. And so I said, well, I'm looking at this fire. And so she ended up basically going and looking into that. And then all of a sudden she said she's going to go talk to Felix, which I was like, well, he's not going to talk to you. and she obviously didn't listen. So anyway.
But he does. And so what happens? She develops this relationship with him that is kind of uncanny. I mean, tell us about what you learned about the way she was gathering information.
Yeah, well, she goes in initially saying, I'm looking into this fire, which was true. And so she was taking pictures of it. Well, Felix Vail just strikes up a conversation with her. He just keeps talking. And so she kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of plays the, in her words, plays the bimbo. You know what I mean? She's like, oh, please tell me more, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And so that's the role she's kind of playing. So she's recording all these conversations.
Is she, so does she have a wire on her? Or?
She put the recorder in her bra. And then later she ended up, I think, having a key fob that actually was a recorder. So you'd use the keys. You know, just leave her keys out, and those were actually the recorder was in that. So,
I mean, you really can't make this stuff up, right? It's a private investigator calls you after the story comes out. Next thing you know, she's pretending to be the guy's girlfriend, got a recorder in her bra, and he's telling her some pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, what did she learn from him in the course of those conversations?
Well, he kind of told his life story and began to flesh out his relationships with some of these women. To my recollection, I don't think he referred to any of them by name, other than, I think, one woman, I think he mentioned by name. And he just kind of told these stories, told about bicycling across California with this young guy. And he talked endlessly about sex and all these women he had bedded. And also, interestingly, started talking about murder. And so he talked about this buddy of his, the same one that gave him the property, started to say he was bothering him. And he says, but he doesn't know how much I know about murder and incapacitation and inflicting pain.
You're going, wow.
Whoa. Not your regular conversation, you know, kind of thing.
But then it seems like the biggest thing that she found was his diaries, right? And all of these documents that he had kept. So tell us about how she managed to find them and what she told you about what was in them.
Well, I knew already that Felix had been keeping journals. You know, I mean, I'd been told that. Like, he had kept a journal his whole life. Felix ends up getting arrested. So she's starting to talk to Felix in April, okay?
Okay.
And then in May, he gets arrested. Well, she's still playing the part of the girlfriend. So he ends up, you know, telling the deputy to give her the keys. So she goes in the house and basically finds the journals and has her camera and basically spent about 16 hours photographing all of his journals, all of his documents.
It's amazing. And she also finds a birth certificate for another man.
Yeah, there's a birth certificate for somebody else.
And a naked photo of a two-year-old.
Yeah.
What else did she?
A two-year-old girl, naked. Naked two-year-old.
Right.
Yeah, you know, this woman, naked woman that looks like she's unconscious, you know, maybe, you know. I was just weird. I mean, there was lots of stuff like
so
that.
So what was the next step after that? I mean, this is an extremely exciting, you know, pivotal moment,
yeah, well,
right? You've been kind of hounding this alleged serial killer for years, and now you have access to his diaries, and you find out that...
So basically, I started spending, like, every weekend reading them. And a lot of it is just his sexual exploits. And then the thing that's real disturbing is his obsession with young children.
Yeah.
Now, he obviously was very mindful of other people ever reading his journals, and that comes through. You can tell he's very mindful of that. At one point, he talks about these women. He says that he was glad, you know, that they couldn't cause pain to anyone anymore.
I see.
You know, and so those are the kinds of things he would say. You know, it wouldn't be what you would call an outright confession, but things that would obviously indicate that he may have done something to these women.
Right. So let's talk about the trial and the prosecution a little bit, because you had been gathering much of this evidence along with folks in law enforcement. And the culmination of it is that there is a prosecution. The trial gets delayed a few times, it sounds like. But take us through what happened.
Finally, the trial happened in August of 2016. And a lot of the witnesses, a lot of the evidence were, you know, things I'd found along the way. So all these things, I mean, this to me shows kind of the power of the press in publishing this, how much people came forward, people came out of the woodwork, people obviously wanting to tell their stories that hadn't been able to tell their stories before, many of them.
What did that feel like for you? It sounds so surreal to have all of this evidence that you had gathered through your reporting presented in court in a criminal prosecution.
Yeah, it was wild. It was definitely interesting, and of course, as a reporter, I mean, you know, you try to fly under the radar a lot of times in terms of like connecting with people and sources and stuff like that. You're not really wanting to be out there, but the trial was, you know, they kept mentioning my name, and it was interesting. And you know, it was an interesting experience.
In the end, Felix Vail is.
In the end, Felix Vail was convicted, and talked to some of the jurors after. The verdict, they brought back a verdict in less than an hour.
So your reporting led to the prosecution of one of the oldest cold cases in history, and it was a successful prosecution. What's that feel like?
Yeah, well, it feels very gratifying. I mean, as reporters, so often what we write about, you know, something may or may not ever happen. You know, you write it, I mean, we've all done that. You write this, what you feel like is this great story, and you know, and nothing happens, and it's so frustrating. So anytime you have something that you write about, and something, you know, like there is a prosecution, you feel gratifying. And I guess the ultimate compliment was at the sentencing in September, where he got up and blamed me. You know, that's the thing you always want as a journalist, right? You always want the guy going out the door, you know, cussing you, you know. And that's what happened.
What did he say?
He said that I was a professional spin master, and that, you know, that Gone, which he read, that I had plagiarized it from James Patterson novels.
That's a pretty nice compliment, too.
I thought that was a pretty good compliment, too.
Yeah, it's master of suspense.
There you go.
Well, it's an absolutely extraordinary run of reporting and writing, and really honored to have you on the program to share it with us.
Well, thanks, Joaquin. Appreciate it.
That was Jerry Mitchell, investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger, explaining how he put to rest one of the oldest cold cases in U.S. history. Felix Vail is now serving a life sentence for the 1962 murder of his first wife, Mary Horton. You've been listening to The Breakthrough, the podcast from ProPublica where investigative journalists reveal how they nailed their biggest stories. Our theme music was composed by Muriel Antoni. Our producer is Kate Brown. Tim Kramer is our engineer. Ibi Caputo edited this episode. Celeste LeCompte is our executive producer, and I'm Joaquin Sapien. Thanks for listening.